Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
When it's really, 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 really hot, and it's July and January, and there's no more snow, and huge waves are wiping out cities, and hurricanes are everywhere, and everyone knows it's a problem.
Many scientists believe global warming is causing permafrost thaw, releasing huge amounts of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, which in turn speeds up global warming. When permafrost melts, huge deposits of organic substances that have been frozen for tens of thousands of years decompose, potentially releasing enormous amounts of methane and carbon dioxide gas. And Russia, which is 60% covered by permafrost, most likely holds the biggest methane threat in the world.
You just heard a short clip from Lori Anderson and from a Greenpeace YouTube video on permafrost. The big question for this program and for the world is, what if the permafrost thaws? I was unable to find a figure for the exact amount of world soil and rock that is frozen. The BBC clip we ran earlier claimed 60% of Russia is permanently frozen ground. There is some permafrost in the Andes of Chile and other high mountains, but most is obviously in Russia, Canada, and Alaska. The United States Permafrost Association estimates about 25% of Earth's surface is frozen. Did you know that? And permafrost may account for up to 40% of all soils on the planet. As you heard from Dr. Levkovitz, interest in these frozen northern soils and rocks dropped until scientists began to calculate a carbon budget for the world. The Wikipedia entry, which is still under construction, says this, quote, "The most recent work investigating the permafrost carbon pool size estimates that 1,400 to 1,700 gigatons of carbon is stored in permafrost soils worldwide. This large carbon pool represents more carbon than currently exists in all living things and twice as much carbon as exists in the atmosphere." Maybe so, but as we'll learn from our next expert, not all of that will reach the atmosphere, and we don't know how long it could take to get there. Dr. Charles Coven is a permafrost and soils expert in the Climate Sciences Department of the Berkeley National Lab in California, along with the renowned Canadian northern soils expert Dr. Charles Tarnakai. Dr. Coven was asked to present at the February meeting of the National Academy for the Advancement of Sciences session called "What If the Permafrost Thaws?" I recorded that session in Vancouver. You can order the whole recording as an MP3 from avon.com as item number 219. I'm going to play you some select audio from the Charles Coven talk. It isn't easy for you and I. First of all, Coven was speaking to experts, not the public. Second, to be frank, neither Coven nor Tarnakai are good public speakers. I think it's too much to ask of our best scientists that they also be master speakers. They spend years in a forbidding field, literally in the cold, and more years working through tedious data in the lab. Their many scientific papers are their voices. So I've selected the best and edited out some of the repetitions and pauses for better radio listening. Before we begin, you'll also need to understand a few phrases and tools used when trying to answer these difficult problems of permafrost. Dr. Levkovitz gave us a leg up. We found out there is no sharp dividing line on a map where permafrost ends, but fingers and islands jutting out from a completely frozen polar area. There is now a free book called The Soil Atlas of the Circumpolar Region. It's available from the European Union. There are three major soil types in the Arctic, and that matters since each releases more or less carbon when they are exposed to decay. As a group, these are called cryosols, or sometimes gelosols in official soil lingo. Complicating it all, the permafrost can be shallow or very, very deep. You might think that once ancient plant material is buried many feet or meters below the ground, below the reach of living roots, it would stay there. But as anybody in cold winters knows, the soil is always heaving. In the Arctic, with summer surface melt and extreme winter cold, soil layers are tossed about in a process called cryoturbation. Cryoturbation, it's a kind of turbulence of the soil. You'll hear that in Charles Coven's talk. Let's quickly hear from an expert who has risen to a high place.
Let me describe one of the tipping points. There's a tremendous amount of carbon in the frozen tundra in Russia, in Canada, and other places. As the Earth warms up, the microbes in that tundra will begin to wake up, and they will begin to chew on this carbon in the form of dead vegetation and reprocess it in the form of carbon dioxide and methane. Once they begin to do that, scientists say that there will be a release of greenhouse gases that will actually create a runaway effect. And by that I mean that they begin to release more carbon dioxide and methane, it goes up into the atmosphere, there's more greenhouse gases that warms the Earth up still more, and it creates a runaway effect. So much so that there is a reasonable probability that once this starts, the amount of greenhouse gases released could then be larger than, it can even dwarf the amount of greenhouse gases that humans are putting in the air now. And at that point, it's completely out of our control, and in the sense that even if the humans stopped emitting more greenhouse gases, the release of the trapped carbon material in the tundra just runs away. We don't know exactly what temperature this is going to occur, but as we go to warmer and warmer temperatures, 4, 5, 6 degrees centigrade, many scientists are feeling that this may really kick in. We cannot go there.
That is Stephen Chu, currently the Secretary of Energy for the United States in the Obama administration. Obviously, he takes thawing permafrost seriously, as should we all. Finally, since we won't know the climate impacts of permafrost thaw until it's much too late, the best we can do is make models from huge masses of scientifically collected data. Talk of complex climate models, woo, that can turn off a lot of radios, I know that. I'm only including a short bit on that subject from Dr. Coven, because I think you need to get a feel for what we know and don't know, and how good those guesses are so far. There are at least a dozen serious teams of climate modelers, some running football-sized buildings stuffed full of supercomputers. Everything from weather records, ocean temperatures, chemical formulae, ice formulations, soil types, and even areas of permafrost are fed into these computers. They are trying to forecast what happens if we burn all the oil, coal, and gas, or just some of it. The results, as you know from the periodic reports of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, are divided into possible scenarios with varying levels of confidence. Dr. Coven quickly references the latest models used for the upcoming IPCC assessment, called CEMA for short, its climate envelope matching. He also talks about RCP Level 5, a scenario which is a moderate projection of 500 parts per million of carbon dioxide equivalent in the atmosphere by the year 2100. That's moderate. And the RPC 8.5 scenario, which would take us beyond 4 degrees of warming by 2100. It's a kind of pedal to the metal vision of human greenhouse gas emissions. Hang in there through that modeling talk and you will be rewarded by some courageous assessments by Dr. Coven of what really happens if the northern lands thaw, plus his surprising and controversial suggestion, which I'm not sure I agree with, that Arctic methane may not be the boogeyman some suggest. Good luck to us all. Here are selections from Charles Coven speaking at the American Academy for the Advancement of Science meeting on February 19th, 2012.
There's this enormous amount of carbon, and you know, one of the main reasons that carbon is there is because it's frozen, right? And so we know that with warming and Arctic amplification, that we expect the largest warming in the world to be right where the largest stock of temperature-sensitive carbon is. So it's sort of an obvious question. What kind of feedbacks can we expect there? But the point here is that there's very high carbon stocks, both in peat soils in Canada and western Siberia, and then also in these highly cryoturbated soils in northern Alaska and in eastern Siberia. We've got similar maps to what Luca was showing with the unfrozen peats, the frozen peats, the non-cryoturbated permafrost soils, which have lower carbon contents, and these highly cryoturbated soils that have higher carbon contents. So one of the tools we have that are available to try and estimate what the magnitude of the feedbacks to climate change are these coupled Earth system models. And so an early intercomparison project of these Earth system models, which is coupled climate, ocean carbon, terrestrial carbon models together, was this Friedenstein et al. C4 MIP intercomparison. And basically, what they if you look at the terrestrial high latitude response to warming in these models, the majority of the models show that a net increase in carbon with warming, i.e., you know, with warming you get increased plant productivity. Increased plant productivity means that you're drawing down carbon, and so it actually acts as a negative feedback. But none of these models included any of the processes responsible for the permafrost carbon pool or the existence of this permafrost carbon pool as well. So the question is, what kind of response do you see if you try and incorporate permafrost carbon processes into these Earth system models? The sort of simplest way of thinking about this is, you know, you've got vegetation, and it grows and dies, and as it dies, it decomposes. And so you've got this constant cycling of carbon between the vegetation and the soil that's in the active layer. And then underneath that, you've got this very much slower exchange between the permafrost carbon pool and the actively cycling pool through cryoturbation or dissolved flow of organic carbon. You know, as you move this permafrost table, then you'll be taking a lot of the carbon from this permafrost pool, moving it up to the active layer. And so it's a different dynamic than what you have if you just look at the cycling between the vegetation and the active layer. So there's a couple of different parts of this problem. One is, can we predict the dynamics of the permafrost? And then can we predict the exchange between the carbon in these different pools and in order to get at the response? So the next thing I want to talk about is modeling permafrost within these land surface models. And so, you know, the simplest way to think about this is, so here you've got just temperature as function of depth, right? And if you imagine a line here for the land surface, and you know, you've got a large seasonal cycle in the atmosphere, and as you go down in depth, that large seasonal cycle attenuates with depth, or you know, some exponential profile. So you've got a maximum summer temperature and a minimum winter temperature, and you know, this dashed line is kind of a mean temperature, and then this dotted line is 0 degrees. And so, you know, the definition of active layer basically is where this maximum temperature intersects with the 0 degree. That depth defines what the active layer is. And so, you know, if you can imagine, if you slide the whole thing to the right, well, that depth will increase, or if you increase the amplitude. But this is a really simple schematic. But there's a lot of things that make this much more complicated. So one is, you know, in the winter you've got snow, and snow acts as a very good insulator, but it's only there during the winter. And so that acts to warm the soil relative to the atmosphere, because you've got this good insulator, big blanket in the winter that keeps you warm, but then it disappears in the summer. Similarly, you've got pretty complicated heat exchange with the atmosphere. So, you know, in the winter, you've got a very stably stratified atmosphere. So it inhibits heat exchange. And in the summer, it's more likely to be turbulent. You'll have better heat exchange. And so those dynamics are also very complex and represented very differently in different climate models. And then you've got questions about, well, you know, what is the soil material? You've got organic peaty materials that have very low heat conductivity but very high porosity, and versus mineral soils which are higher conductivity and lower porosity. And so, in general, it actually turns out to be a much more complicated question of how the soil thermal regime, you know, interacts with climate. So one question you can say is, well, do the climate models that exist, right? And here we've got four representatives from the next phase of the IPCC. Each IPCC report involves a big coupled climate model in a comparison project. And so right now I've taken data from CMIP-5, which is the most recent assemblage of climate models that is sort of being released right now. And saying, okay, well, if you look at the temperature dynamics and you say, well, which grid cells have a layer that stays frozen all year? And we'll say that a layer within the top 3 meters or 5 meters, somewhere in that range, call that our near surface permafrost. And if we look at those climate models and compare that with observations, do the models do a reasonable job of simulating where the permafrost is? And so one thing is, in reality, you've got a whole gradient of, from continuous to sporadic and isolated permafrost. The models can't do that. They're just looking at, single grid cells. So each grid cell either is or is not permafrost. And so you either have continuous or nothing. And another thing to look at here is, so the black line, which unfortunately you can't really see very well, is the 0 degree isotherm in the air temperature. And so you might expect, okay, well, the permafrost maybe lines up more or less, permafrost boundary lines up more or less with where the 0 degree isotherm is. But it's actually more complex than that, because in general, the continuous permafrost is quite a bit, covers a much smaller area than the 0 degree air. And the reason for that is the snow thermal insulation and things like that make the soils generally warmer than the air. And so one question is, are the models doing a decent job of that? And there's a range of them. Some models, like the HAD-GEM, the permafrost extent and the 0 degree isotherm line up perfectly well. So you don't have any of that effect. Other models have sort of two warm soils, and some of them, like CCSM-4, is probably doing a reasonably good job in terms of the soil temperature. Another question is, well, okay, what about the active layer thickness? And here's a map of what the active layer thicknesses looks like. So basically, you start with fairly thin active layers, and they get much, you know, even where you still have permafrost going forward, you have much deeper active layers. And so as a result, you've transferred a lot of soil from what was in the permafrost, and now it's in the active layer. Another paper by Dave Lawrence and colleagues looking using a different model show, you know, a similar thing where you have this, you know, pretty dramatic drop in the active layer or in the extent of permafrost with warming. And that, and this is a crucial point, that like the extent of warming actually really matters here. So in this RCP 8.5, which is a pretty extreme warming case, you end up losing the majority of permafrost within this century, at least in the near surface, down to 3 meters. There's still permafrost still below that because it takes a little while for the thaw to propagate downwards below the near surface. Before I showed a couple papers, now, like, what do all the models show? And one of the values of this is that you're sampling a range of different things. The total amount of warming, the total warming at high latitudes versus low latitudes, the communication of that warming from the air to the land surface. And what you see is that, you know, in this RCP 4.5, which is moderate warming, you know, ending with about 500 ppm by 2100, you see, you know, a significant loss of permafrost, somewhere in the range of between 20 and say 50% of permafrost lost based on these models. And there's some outliers. And one of the things we're doing right now is trying to develop a real set of metrics in order to throw out the models that aren't doing a good job. And so, you know, one way you can say is the ones that predict really low permafrost to begin with or really high permafrost to begin with, they're probably doing something wrong. Similarly, you know, if the active layer distribution is not at all reasonable, the model's probably doing something wrong. And so if you look at the models that get things more or less right for current conditions, those models, you know, all tend to be kind of clumped in the center of these distributions. So in this RCP 8.5 scenario, you end up with, you know, with somewhere in the range of 60 to 80% permafrost loss by 2100 in these surface layers. So it's not just the couple models that have been used to publish this. It seems to be a pretty robust response for a lot of these models. And so if you think about it in terms of a distribution function, a cumulative distribution function of what the active layer thickness looks like, you know, so if this is, here's depth here, and if at some depth, say a meter, you know, you say, what's the chance of being in permafrost versus in the active layer? And so if what the model's predicting is that at a meter, you know, currently you've got about a 40% chance of being in permafrost and a 60% chance of being in the active layer. Well, as you warm up, the lines move to the right. So now you're, by 2100, even under this moderate warming scenario, you've gone, at that same depth, you've gone to about a 20%. So you've lost, you know, you've essentially doubled the probability of being in the active layer. You expect the total amount of carbon to be not necessarily least, but vulnerable to thawing, to be proportional to the thickness of this change. Right? So at the surface, you're already pretty much starting on the active layer. So you're not really very sensible to changes in the active layer thickness at the surface. Whereas at depth, you're starting off almost entirely in the permafrost. And so any change in the permafrost extent corresponds to a change in the total amount of carbon that's now vulnerable. And again, so in this RCP 8.5, which is a much more severe warming, you end up with, you know, much more significant movement of carbon from permafrost to the active layers. So now we've looked at what the models are predicting for the temperature response. And the next question is, can we compare that to observations of what the vertical profiles of soil carbon look like and how much carbon you expect to be vulnerable to thaw as a result of this warming? So this is some work that a lot of people have been contributing to, which creates sort of representative carbon profiles for different types of soils. So here we've got the same three types of soils that Charles and Luca were talking about before. So you've got histels, which are frozen peat soils, orthels, which are not peat, they're mineral soils, but they're not cryoturbated, and you've got turbels, which are cryoturbated mineral soils. And so you've got depth down to about 2.5 meters here.
We are listening to excerpts from a speech by Charles Coven of Berkeley National Labs. He is developing the latest scientific assessments on the impact of permafrost thaw on the world's climate. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with expert answers to the question, what happens if the permafrost thaws? Following our opening interview with Canada's Antony Levkovich, we're hearing from Dr. Charles Coven, a climate expert from the Earth Sciences Division of the Berkeley National Lab in California. Our recording comes from the AAAS meeting in Vancouver, February 2012.
The point is you can then add up all this carbon and say, okay, well, something like 1,700 petagrams of carbon, but with a really wide range, somewhere between 500 as a minimum estimate and 3,000 as a maximum estimate. The range is just based on the standard deviation of all these soil profiles is there. And of that, maybe 950 is actually in these permafrost layers. And then as you warm, how much of it gets released. So under the most extreme warming scenario, potentially to 700 petagrams is now vulnerable to thaws. Again, with a large range, between 250 and 1,200 petagrams of carbon is now been thawed, which is different. It has not necessarily ended up in the atmosphere yet, but now it's been thawed and is now more vulnerable than it was before to decomposition. That gives you an estimate of what the total change in carbon might be, or what the total amounts of vulnerable carbon as a result of warming might be. But there's no real ability to say, okay, well, how does that actually end up in the atmosphere? What are the rates of it going to the atmosphere? In order to actually get that, one way to do it is take sort of the standard soil model that people have been using in land surface models, which is basically these box models, and you say, okay, We'll put some of the carbon in these different pools and assign a time scale that it stays in the pool for these different time scale. And so typically people haven't ever thought about what's the depth distribution of the soil carbon. But for the permafrost, that ends up being critical. So instead of taking this box modeling approach, you distribute the soil carbon vertically, give it a clear vertical distribution of what the soil is. And then as you change the temperature and moisture environment of the soils with warming, then the carbon would respond. But the first carbon, somebody have to get the carbon down there, right? Because the plants don't really have roots in the permafrost. So the plants, the leaves and roots turn over all in the active layer. And so you have to include this very slow mixing process from the active layer down into the permafrost in order to get that. And so, there's a sort of a long history in climate models of representing turbulent processes, which, one way of thinking about this cryoturbation is this is a very slow, turbulent mixing. It's just a straight diffusive process with a very slow time scale. And if you do that, then you end up with, it's going from a vertical distribution of carbon that looks like something like this to anywhere where you're now mixing the carbon down deeper into the permafrost. And so you've got more carbon that's vulnerable should the temperature, environment, and depth change. And what that looks like in terms of the map is without any mixing, you don't have much carbon in the permafrost. And with mixing, you end up with a lot more carbon in the permafrost. We're still probably underestimating the carbon relative to the observations, particularly because we're not representing this anoxic peat accumulation processes yet. And that's something that we're working on, but is not incorporated in the model yet. And so we're really looking more at these mineral soils. And if you then take that model and run it through this warming experiment, and so the blue line is control, which is sort of like the C4 MIP results that I showed in my first slide. Not much of a response. The loss of carbon from the soil is basically canceled out by the gain of carbon because of increased vegetation productivity. And this orange line, which includes all these permafrost processes, you change it to something like a 60 petagram carbon loss from the soils into the atmosphere with warming. And so, yeah, this is actually a pretty important process that you want to be able to capture in these models if you in terms of understanding how the total feedback process works between the atmosphere and the land surface. And then another question that always comes up with this is, well, what happens with the methane? And at least in the model we developed, the methane response is actually quite a bit smaller than the total carbon process. And one of the reasons for that is that the methane is constantly cycling anyway. And so there's these methane emissions just from natural wetlands at high latitude. And so as you thaw the carbon, the deep stuff, it already is pretty slow to turn over. When there's no oxygen available, it turns over even in order of magnitude slower than that already. And so at least on the sort of 100-year time scale, it seems like that carbon might not come out as this catastrophic methane burst that you read about in the newspaper. But it's more like another term, but much smaller, especially in terms of its radiative impact. One of the things to know here is that in terms of the methane, the radiative impact of methane, or you often read this number of 25, methane 25 times more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2, right? So if you actually look at what the definition of that number is, 25 is in kilograms of methane divided by the kilograms of CO2. But when you take carbon, the soil, and you make it CO2 versus methane, those two oxygen atoms actually weigh a lot, right? So the molecular weight of CO2 is 44 versus molecular weight of 16 for methane. So you actually have to do that correction. And so you end up not with a 25 times more powerful greenhouse gas on a mole per mole basis, but a 9 times more powerful. So it's still important. But because the turnover in these anoxic systems is an order of magnitude less, it ends up kind of canceling each other out. So you've a more powerful greenhouse gas, but it comes out much slower. And so the CO2 ends up being a much larger impact in terms of the total effect on the climate. Some conclusions. And so, I put up the Wile E. Coyote here because basically get across this idea that one of the interesting aspects of this problem is that by the time we get to the point where this matters, there's this huge delay, right? You have this warming, and the warming takes a long time for that warming to propagate into the soil, and then it takes a long time for that, particularly in terms of the permafrost, then it has to come out. You then start slowly decomposing this carbon, and it lasts for a really long time. And so it's not this sort of direct feedback response. It's this really long delay. And so it's a little bit like Wile E. Coyote. You know, not to say that the permafrost is going to be the thing that leads to global catastrophe, because it's a term, but it's not the end of the planet or something like that. But it does have this built-in delay. And so if we get to the point where we start really seeing the permafrost thawing in a big way, in a sense we've gone off the cliff already. Basically, so what are some take-homes of how this might actually play out? So one thing is in terms of the total loss of permafrost, right? So it matters a lot between these sort of moderate warming scenarios and high warming scenarios, where with high warming you can really lose the vast majority of permafrost, whereas with moderate warming there'll still be quite a bit of permafrost left, at least by 2100. And then the total amount of carbon that might be coming out, somewhere in the range of 50 to 100 petagrams of carbon. Probably actually I should draw the error bars wider than that, because we really our confidence is pretty low in what this number is. But it's a it's a globally relevant number. So that's between 25 and 50 ppm CO2 increase. So that's it's equivalent to 10 or 20 years of CO2 increase at current rate. So it's not a nothing. It's it's a significant thing. On the other hand, it's not equal to an extra 100 years of CO2 emissions, right? It increases the total sensitivity of the planet by, somewhere in the 10 to 20% range. Another thing is that the CO2 is much more important than methane in terms of the total radiative forcing response, at least using the mechanisms that we're including here, which do not include things like, methane hydrate clathrates that, as Charles said, are much deeper in the soil, and so you expect to have happen much slower. The total amount of carbon that's going to be thawed is potentially much larger than what we're predicting to actually end up in the atmosphere. So this could continue for a very long time. Once the thaw happens, then you have this very, very long tail of carbon being emitted from these soils, and they could go on for a very long time. So, what are some next steps? One crucial thing here is we've essentially completely neglected any of these small-scale processes, things like thaw lakes, wetland dynamics, and linkages to river networks. And so there's a really big push to link these fine-scale processes into the global models. And so, for example, the DOE has a new project, NG, which is really focused on this question of what are small-scale processes and how do those impact the larger scale. Another thing that we're trying to wrestle with right now is what are the nutrient dynamics and feedbacks between the vegetation and soil? So as you release this carbon and mineralize it, you also mineralize a lot of nitrogen, which could stimulate plant productivity and act as a negative feedback. And there are more complex vegetation feedbacks, for example, with fire. If you change the vegetation type, you could increase the fire frequency and change the dynamics that way. So there's a lot more really complex dynamics that are not being represented yet that we're trying to sort of wrestle with.
That was Dr. Charles Coven from the Berkeley National Labs from the National Academy for the Advancement of Science presentation, What If the Permafrost Thaws? That was February 19, 2012. You can get a full recording of the event with Coven, moderator Luca Montanarella of the European Union, and the highly regarded Canadian expert Charles Tarnakai as an MP3 download. That costs you $20 from avn.com. That's AVEN.com. Look for recording number AS2019. Find more links in my Radio EcoShock blog for this program at ecoshock.info. That's ecoshock.info. Or you can listen again to the show and pass it around as a free MP3 from our program archives at ecoshock.org. Should we worry about the permafrost thaw? Maybe not today or tomorrow. The big thaw is happening slowly. It will define the history of the planet. As the Russian expert Sergei Kropotkin of Tomsk University says, the process is already underway. We can delay it with smarter energy choices and greenhouse gas control, but unless a miracle happens, over the next century or three, planet Earth will thaw. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I appreciate your patience and your brain power. Thank you for caring about your world.
But when an expert says it's a problem, and makes a movie about the problem, and wins an Oscar about the problem, and gets the Nobel Prize about the problem, then all the other experts have to agree. It is most likely a problem. 'Cause only an expert can deal with the problem at all.